offer my apologies to the moderator for jumping the gun. And I begin as I did by saying that my claims this morning are quite simple, and that is that it's more reasonable to believe in God than to reject the hypothesis of God by appealing to chance. God as creator and chance are the only two options as an explanation of the universe. Atheists aren't agnostics. Agnostics claim they don't know or they're not interested in this question. Atheists state quite clearly there is no God. For atheists, the universe is a product of blind chance, has no purpose, perhaps just a brute fact. So humans are like a froth on the wave, sometimes pretty, sometimes dangerous, always inconsequential. I believe that goodness, truth, and beauty call for an explanation, as do the principles of mathematics, physics, and especially the purpose-driven miracles of biology, which run at least through this earth. And the human capacities to recognize these qualities of truth, goodness, and beauty, to invent and construct, also call for an explanation. The Irish philosopher Brendan Purcell cites the frequently used quotation from Einstein that the one thing that is unintelligible about the universe is its intelligibility. From the beginning, it's also important to realize that in arguing for God, we're not claiming the existence of a super-quality physical cause or phenomenon accessible to science within the universe. God is not some fantastic, hyper-successful UFO, unidentified flying object. The philosopher and the atheist, Thomas Nagel, explains that the purpose of the God hypothesis is to claim that not everything is physical, and that there is a mental, purposive, or intentional explanation more fundamental than the basic laws of physics, because it explains even them. By definition, God must be self-sufficient, the reason for his own existence, which is a statement that young children and others, initially at least, don't find a very satisfactory answer to their frequent question, who made God? Different categories of believers believe in different types of God. Deists do not accept that God is in any sense personal, but as the supreme being, the creator, the intelligence, which doesn't intervene in the universe. Pantheists identify God with the universe, regarding the universe as a manifestation of God. So that the mighty, often uncontrollable forces of nature often produce awe in every type of person. Monotheists believe only one God exists, and traditional monotheists, such as Jews, Christians, and Muslims, believe God to be transcendent and personal in some superior sense. And there's only one God. There's not a Christian God, and also a Muslim God, and also a Jewish God. There's one God that is described and approached in different ways. In other words, the one transcendent is God is not on our level of reality, not even as a thermonuclear trigger or a giant rocket which set off the Big Bang at the start of the universe. God is beyond space and time, not part of the natural order, and therefore not open to observation by the natural sciences. And hence, we therefore, talking about God, we have to philosophize. We're going with or after physics, we're doing metaphysics. We're philosophers. I've got quite a splendid book here by a fellow called Anthony Flew. His publicist claimed that he used to be the best-known atheist in the world, British philosopher. It's a splendidly written, and he's now discovered God. It's a beautifully written book and very accessible. So whether you believe or don't believe in God, this is as good a case you'll get rationally for the existence of God. His most controversial claim in the book is, as I quote, that of all the discoveries of modern science, the greatest discovery of modern science is God. This is provocative for unbelievers, especially unbelieving scientists, and provocative for believers who know that the roots of monotheism are found with Abraham about 3,700 or 3,900 years ago. I repeat that we cannot arrive to God within the framework of science because God is outside science and time. And I also repeat that the God for which we are arguing is not a God of the gaps. It is the whole of the universe which is not self-explanatory. All us as humans, not self-explanatory. And the infrastructure and elements we understand scientifically, neither are they self-explanatory. Many people over the ages have found evidence of the mind of God in the laws of nature, in their regularity and symmetry, and some now more in the richness and unpredictability of the universe. The law of the conservation of energy, Newton's first law of motion, and Boyle's law, mathematically precise regularities, universal and tied together, are the examples Flew gives as he asks how and why nature is packaged in this way. Flew shows that as well as Einstein, and I'll quote from him, the great scientists who developed quantum physics, Max Planck, Werner Heisenberg, Erwin Schrödinger, and Paul Dirac, were all theists, all believers in God. And even Charles Darwin rejected blind chance or necessity as the cause of the universe and looked to a first cause with an intelligent mind. A number of writers espouse a theory called the weak anthropic principle, which is, and I quote, that matter evolved in an elaborate, finely tuned conspiracy to produce air-breathing, carbon-based life forms possessed of self-consciousness. Others have claimed as much by saying the universe knew we were coming. The universe is finely tuned. If the value of even one of the fundamental constants, the speed of light, or the mass of an electron, had been slightly different, then no planet capable of producing life could have formed. Other examples abound. If the nuclear strong force had been slightly weaker, it's holding the atom together, no element heavier than hydrogen would have been formed. If the Big Bang had been more vigorous, matter could not have formed into stars and planets. If it had been less, probably the planets would have been immensely larger. The one-force strength of electromagnetism enables carbon synthesis to occur in stars, allows stars to burn steadily for billions of years and atoms to exist, and ensures protons behave in a way so that chemistry is possible. This is not the result of blind chance. And neither do we have a satisfactory explanation for the origin of life from non-living matter. For the fact, for example, that every animal for 600 million years has the same body plan, with the exception of the jellyfish. Living beings, or living matter, are purpose-driven and directed. Aristotle, the great Greek philosopher, is evident in their innate activity. The baby moving towards the breast of its mother soon after birth. A caterpillar developing into a butterfly. And on top of this, all forms of life are able to reproduce themselves. And new and different species emerge in some mysterious way. Another mystery of life is the origin of the coding and information processes in all life forms. The cell is a system which stores, processes, and replicates information. Flew became a theist. He changed his mind after studying the directive capacity of DNA, whose genetic message is replicated and transcribed to RNA, then into the amino acids, which are then assembled into proteins. How blind and purposeless forces could spontaneously produce such a process is unknown, and I believe unknowable, metaphysically impossible. Even the atheist Nobel Prize-winning biologists like Jacques Monod and the DNA co-discoverer Francis Crick regard the emergence of life from chemical realities as almost miraculous. Crick even believed that somehow the inanimate life on Earth was seeded from space living material. Some have alleged that life might have arisen by chance, but calculations and experiments have shown that the odds have been impossibly high. Moving from amino acids to life, there's one chance in 10 to the power of 14,000, an unimaginable number. The number of subatomic particles in the Eucharist is 10 to the power of 80 or 81. Life didn't come about by chance.
I'd like to thank Father Bell for these insights, and I now call upon Dan Barker to open case for the native.
Thank you, Nick, and thank you, George. Thank you, Radar, and Tristan. Where's Tristan?
Are you?
Tristan. Show us your shirt. He's got a great shirt on here. It's big, the big A atheist symbol, and what does it say underneath there? Good without God. So I think you guys have some for sale there. I wasn't going to plug your table, but of course you can be good without God. That's not even an open question. That's just a fact. Millions of good people all over the planet are good without believing in a God. I flew to Sydney last night. This is my first day in Australia. And this is probably no big deal to you, but I saw some wild ibises right out here, which we don't see in Wisconsin, you know. If you saw a wild bear, you'd probably jump, but it's a real pleasure to be invited to this wonderful country and to see such wonderful thinkers on all sides of the issue, and to be able to debate and dialogue with an informed and compassionate and kind man such as George Pell. Today is, what day of the week is it today? Thursday. You know what that is? We're honoring the existence of the god Thor. Isn't that the god they worship, Radar, in Norway, where you're from? There you go. So, how many of you in this audience believe in the actual existence of Thor? No? And George doesn't either, do you? The only difference between me and George is that I believe in one less god than he does. We all reject beliefs in many types of gods, and I reject belief in the God of the Bible for very good reasons. And of course, I used to believe, as you know, I used to be a preacher. I used to travel the country trying to convert people to Christianity, and I was actually good at it as it goes. I wrote some Christian musicals. I'm still getting royalties today from some of those musicals. What should I do with the money? I changed my mind, and I wrote some books about it. My newest book is called Godless, and it explains in great detail, more detail than we can talk about tonight, why I changed my mind. So, without God, are we nothing? Let me ask you atheists and agnostics in the audience, are you nothing?
No.
Aren't you something? Aren't we biological animals? Don't we come with instincts and drives and even, as George points out, purpose to reproduce, to live, to enjoy life? Are we nothing? Who would dare insult our species by saying that our wonderful, beautiful, learning, imperfect, and yet struggling to improve species is merely nothing? Maybe people like George, without God, would feel that they are nothing. They wouldn't have those honorifics or those awards granted to them by a church based on an intellectually feeble book, a scientifically illiterate book, a morally inadequate book of the Bible, an entire world religion based upon very poor teachings. Any one of us in this room could have come up with a better system of thought and morality than that book or the church that George is advocating for. We are something. We exist. The reasons I gave for rejecting my original belief in God, which was sincere and deep. I used to pray. I used to feel the Spirit. I used to see what I thought were miracles. I used to see what I thought would transform lives. But I changed my mind because it intellectually does not make sense. It is much more reasonable not to believe in a God than to pretend that these arguments for a God make any sense. Reason number one is that there's no evidence for a God. Come on, if there were evidence for a God, we would have heard it tonight. George would have put it on the table and said, here's the evidence for God. Instead, what we heard was evidence for mystery. And George went out of his way to remind us that his arguments are not gods of the gap arguments, but in fact, that's exactly what they are. Here's a mystery. How do you answer it? God did it. Isn't that convenient? How do you explain the fine-tuning of the initial constants? I don't know. God did it. That's not evidence. If there were evidence for a God, by now, someone should have won the Nobel Prize for pointing that out. Of course, George is careful to point out that the existence of God is not accessible to natural inquiry, which conveniently removes it from real investigation. Although I think that Dawkins is right to suggest that a universe with a God in it would be different than a universe without a God, and therefore the question of God is, in fact, a scientific question. If a God does exist, as opposed to not existing, we should have some evidence to show the existence of that being. None of that evidence has been offered tonight, and really none of that evidence holds any water. Prophecies, supposed miracles, answers to prayer, changed lives, the existence of the Bible, the existence of the church, all these things are not evidences for a God. They are evidence for a beautifully creative human species trying to make sense of the world that we live in. The second reason is that there are no good arguments for a God. The first cause, the fine-tuning, the teleological, the design arguments, we don't have time to touch on those or the ontological or the moral argument or any of the others today in this brief debate. But when you scratch beneath the surface, I have to agree with Bertrand Russell that all these arguments boil down to bad grammar. They really are not, they really do not produce the results even that the theists are aiming for. And to George's credit, he even admits in his writings that these arguments could be stronger, but they are what they are. The church has these arguments and they are using them. But when I scratch beneath the surface, I realize that the question that the little child asked, who made God, is actually a very good question. If we have to ask, if we are allowed to ask that question of ourselves in our universe, why is God exempt from the same question? George says, by definition, he necessarily exists. But that's just called begging the question, the circular logic. Another reason, number three, is there's never been a coherent definition of a God ever offered. No one has ever defined what a God is. In fact, many of the definitions, including the Christian definition of God, most Christian definitions, define God in ways that are mutually incompatible. It's like arguing whether or not a married bachelor exists. The God of Christianity is a God who knows the future and is all-powerful and has free will, and yet, if you know the future, you can't change the future. It's an argument I came up with called FANG, the free will argument for the non-existence of God. If God knows the future, he is powerless to change it. And to say that he somehow lives outside of time means that he doesn't exist. To live outside of existence is not to exist. No one has ever properly defined the word spirit or spiritual or supernatural. Those are simply words. George, in his works, uses the word beyond and wider. The spiritual word is beyond, it is wider. But what does the word beyond and wide mean? Aren't those dimensional words? Aren't those natural words? Until you theists define properly the words you are using, you may as well just say God is a blum. Because what does the word spirit mean? How do you measure it? How much does it weigh? How much space does it take up? How does the spirit differ from nothing at all? Isn't it just a word? A fourth reason is that there are no good replies to the positive arguments against the existence of a God. Walk into any children's hospital and you know there is no God. Those parents who desperately love their children, they're praying, they're asking for a miracle, and yet they see those children die horrible deaths at the same rate as random chance. If there were a God, the universe should be different from what it is. A fifth reason is that there is no agreement among believers themselves as to the nature or the moral principles of this God that they are asking us to believe in. You take any moral issue of the day, you name it, birth control, stem cell research, the death penalty, gay marriage, doctor-assisted suicide, you name these issues, you find devout, Bible-believing, church-going Christians and other religious people on opposite sides of those issues. There is no agreement among believers. I think we atheists are justified in folding our arms and asking you to get your act together first before you ask us to join this supposed fragmented cause of yours. Even Paul in the Bible wrote, God is not the author of confusion. But can you think of a single book that's caused more confusion than the Bible? It's all over the place. Catholics killing Protestants, Protestants killing Catholics, Jews killing Muslims, and so on. And yet all of them supposedly believe in this God. Finally, the sixth reason is there's no need for a belief in a God. Millions, tens of millions of good people, many of them in this room today, do not believe in a God, and yet we have meaning, purpose, love, joy, fulfillment in our lives that is just as amazing and wonderful as those of, maybe even more, because we are not contingent upon a future reward or a fear of hell to get it. So, with God or without God, are we nothing? Tell that to those millions of good people who find that it is true, there is no purpose of life, nor should we want there to be a purpose of life. If there is a purpose of life, that cheapens life. That makes us less. It's like the hymn that says, God, you are everything and I am nothing. If there is a God, we are subservient in the universe. We are secondary. We are children. We are slaves. If there is a God, we are truly nothing.
Thank you, Andrew, for your comments, and I now call on Senator Scott Opel to respond.
Thank you, Dan. I think it's evident that we're talking at cross purposes. I spoke for 10 minutes talking about the intellectual patterns, the beautiful principles, fantastic equations, the miracles of life that are exist within the universe, and to say that they require to be understood an intelligence. They can't be just the product of brute chance. Dan says there's only one difference between us, and that is that he believes in one less God. Now, I prefer to put it another way. I'm offering an explanation, and so far what Dan has done is just offered an affirmation, a disclaimer. Now, of course, I realise that atheists exist, and of whatever I meant by without, or whatever the title means, without God we are nothing, is not true in that sense. My claim is that without God there is nothing. There is no explanation. I certainly didn't claim that you can't argue to God. What I said was that in the terms of physical science, you can't argue to God without doing metaphysics, without reasoning about that evidence. But the whole of my talk was to try to spell out the logic of believing in a superior intelligence. And whether that is loving or not, as we Christians believe, I think that's something to be held to have a revelation. There are no good arguments, there's only bad grammar. I don't think you can reduce the laws of nature to that. If Dan thinks that the laws of nature are just bad grammar, I suggest he step out the window and see whether the laws of gravity are functioning. The human intelligence has detected and discovered so many of these fantastic exhibitions of intelligence and mathematical competence. Now, Dan seems to think that God is like the bloke next door. He says he can't be a married bachelor. That's true. Can't. God can't have his cake and eat it. We can't define God, because to define, you put person in a species. We can't. But we can say useful things about God. God is intelligent. God is spiritual. And what does he say? There's no definition of the spirit. With the kids, I say, think of your parents' love for you. It's very real, very powerful, quite invisible. Honor, forgiveness, disgrace. They're all powerful spiritual realities. The spirit is real. It's just a little bit like the force of gravity. Real, powerful, and invisible. A little bit like the magnetic force that runs between the north and the south poles. God is a spirit. God is fantastically intelligent, and God loves us.
Thank you, Michael, for his comments, and now invite Dan to respond.
So we've just seen two new debate tactics. One of them is to accuse your opponent of failing to rebut your arguments before your opponent gets to his rebuttal. The second is to misrepresent your opponent. I never said that the laws of nature are bad grammar. What Bertrand Russell and I say is that the arguments that theists have used to prop up their belief, those arguments are bad grammar. Imagine you're going to be killed by a firing squad. You're blindfolded and you're told that there's 100 expert riflemen who have never missed. They're going to be conducting the execution. You hear, ready, aim, fire, and you hear the blasts, but nothing, you're still there. You think, why am I still here? I must be just blind chance. Would anyone say that? You'd be looking for an explanation properly, as George is doing. When you look at the fine-tuning of the universe, why are we here? Why are we not a stillborn dead universe? Does it look like the universe was expecting us, doesn't it? Maybe there was a conspiracy. Maybe all the rifles jammed at once. Maybe they really liked me and they missed on purpose. You know, you can think of all these reasons, but suppose you take off your blindfold and you discover that there were 101 prisoners that day being executed. None of them missed. They all killed somebody, but with the 101 prisoners, one of them by chance is going to survive. Cosmologists are now convinced, even Paul Davies, who was a skeptic, that some form of a multiverse is most likely, that our particular universe that we live in is just one of billions and perhaps maybe an infinite number of bubble universes within a huge champagne glass. They are now actually finding, I just read in Scientific American, ways that they are able to measure the probabilities of the existence of the different constants within a universe. It is not so amazing that we live in the universe that has the fine constants finely tuned the way they are, because we wouldn't be observing it if we weren't. I wouldn't be the surviving prisoner. It wouldn't have to be me. It could have been one of the other prisoners. In fact, now scientists are sure that George is right, by the way, that if you do mess with one of the initial constants, let's say you have a stack of rocks that's just teetering right in the balance of falling, and you push this rock this way, the whole thing's going to come tumbling down, right? And George is right about that. The fine tuning of the constants appears to be balanced just to support life. But scientists now know that there are other ways to make a universe. If I press up here on this rock this way, but I press down here on this rock this way, I can keep the thing in balance. There are many, many, many more ways for the formation of the heavy elements to have come into existence than just the one way in the one particular universe that we think of. It's not blind chance. In fact, a true miracle, given the number of potential universes, the true miracle would be that no life ever evolved anywhere. That would need an explanation. The fact that life evolved is incredible, but we are incredibly lucky. If you buy a lottery ticket and you win against stupendous odds, are you going to say, wait a minute, the odds were too great, I cannot have won this lottery? Are you going to say that, or are you going to take the money, right? Obviously, somebody's going to win that lottery, and it just seems like a miracle when it happens to you. Well, we have won a cosmic lottery here. Billions and billions and billions of other potential universes are stillborn. They are dead. There was no form. There was no gravitational attraction for whatever under these scenarios. So your fine-tuning argument doesn't hold water. Antony Flew, by the way, did not convert to theism. Theism is a belief in a personal God. If you read his works, he converted at most to a weak form of deism, an initial force. He does not believe in miracles. He doesn't believe in revelation. He does not believe in Jesus. He did not believe in any of the gods that any of us believe in this room. Antony Flew is not a theist by even the widest stretch of the imagination, although he did concede scientifically, based on some of the bad arguments, which scientists are now clearing up, about the fine-tuning of the initial constants. And during my second rebuttal, I will address more of George's opening remarks.
Thank you, Dan, for his comments. I invite the upper panel to take the floor in some further rebuttal.
Well, I've got Antony Flew's book here, and you can see the title of it. And it's got, originally, Why There Is No God, and he's crossed out the no, and then he's put Why There Is A God. He is certainly a theist. He certainly doesn't believe in life after death, at least in this book he doesn't. There is a postscript by Tom Wright, the Anglican Bishop of Durham, putting out the Christian side of things, which really doesn't exist, but except. But Flew certainly is a theist, not in the full Christian sense. The last time I was speaking to Paul Davies, he certainly didn't believe in multiple universes. Now, he might have changed his mind just recently, but of course there is not a skerrick of evidence for multiple universes. And even if there was, it wouldn't make the atheist problem any less. Matter of fact, if there were other worlds, and Christians believe in another supernatural, spiritual world of angels and things like that, if there were other worlds, it magnifies the atheist problem, because all the problems they have in, as they fail to explain this universe, are multiplied for every other universe that exists. That's no sort of answer whatsoever. Dan believes that life is like winning a lottery. In other words, exactly as I said, he believes in chance. And he said, we're very lucky. We are, especially those of us who live in Australia. But let me just repeat what the odds are. One chance of moving from amino acids to life, not from nothing to something, from amino acids to life, is one chance in 10 to the power of 40,000. Unimaginable number. Some have suggested could have been come about by chance, and so what chance is there that six chimpanzees on a on typewriters might produce a Shakespearean sonnet? Somebody got six chimpanzees together and they battered away for 6 months and they never produced one word. They couldn't even get an A, that is an A with a gap before and a gap afterwards. Our world exists. It requires an intelligence. We have that intelligence. It's quite unworthy to bail out and say that there is no answer. And to slip from saying there is no God and over to the slightly easier position saying, well, we're not quite sure, or putting forward the bizarre theory that life is the result of winning a lottery.
Thank you, Cardinal, for his comments, and invite Dan to take the floor with some further rebuttal.
Of course, if there is a God who created all of this, he has an intelligence that is functioning in a finely tuned way. This God has purpose, has a direction, has some functionality to its brain and its mind, has desires, has wants, has needs to create things. However you define this God, it is not a simple thing. It is an incredibly complex being. What George has done is he's trying to explain complexity with more complexity. If you answer one mystery with another mystery, you've answered nothing. You've simply delayed the question. Even a child knows to ask, well, if God made everything, who made God? And to simply posit that God, by definition, has his own self-explanation is to beg the question. You need to give us some kind of an evidence for this being before you posit it as a self-existing being. Paul Davies and I were co-presenters at a conference in 2004, that was 6 years ago, during which Paul Davies said that some form of a limited multiverse is most likely. He has changed his mind, you are right. He was opposed to multiverse, but more and more scientists now are agreeing that the existence of the dark matter, for example, is more logically explained by a multiverse scenario of some sort. And if we can find good models, in fact, two completely different approaches to coming up with a measurement for the probabilities, because you know the only way to compute a probability is by dividing one number by another. So where do you get those numbers, right? How do you know that those constants could have been different from what they are, and by how much? How do you know that unless you have some sense of probabilities? Two completely different scientific approaches to trying to assess that have come exactly at this, converged at the exact same amount of existence of dark matter that needs an explanation in the universe. Therefore, the hypothesis, and it is a hypothesis, I admit, of multiverses, is mathematically supported as opposed to the hypothesis, and George admits that God is a hypothesis, of this super complex being up there who doesn't need an explanation for its complexity, although we do. If you're going to pick one hypothesis over another, which one is more simple? Which one makes more sense? You use that number 10 to the 40,000th power. Yes, that's kind of true. Hoyle talked about that, but he was talking about one particular amino acid using one shake of the box. If you had a bunch of random elements and you shook the box once, what are the odds that they would form into that one amino acid? They are extremely high. But 10 to the 40,000th power, which is unimaginably large. But what if there are 10 to the 50,000th power possible multiverses? Then you would expect some of it. In fact, mathematically, it would be a miracle if that amino acid did not form. The problem we have is our failure to imagine the law of large numbers. We evolve thinking in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 100, thousands. But if the universe is unimaginably large, then of course, someone's going to win that lottery more than once. Is that the final time? Or is one more minute? Okay. By the way, if monotheism was a great improvement over polytheism, what's the next logical improvement? George makes another assumption in his remarks that which is mental is non-physical. I don't think anyone supports that claim. I think believers might support that claim. A mental activity is a physical activity. It is a description of a function. Thoughts are not things, they are functions. Be like me saying digestion is a thing. Digestion is just a label for the function of an organ. Thoughts and mental processes are labels, it's a label for functioning of an organ. You cannot have thoughts without some kind of an organ functioning. If the stomach disappears, digestion disappears. If the brain dies, our thoughts die. Mental activity is not immaterial. Thank you, George. You're very articulate. Good thinker, good writer, good man. Can you define for us what, using positive terms, what is a spirit and how that would differ from nothing at all in positive terms?
I've just said that I can't define God, but I can say something useful about spirit, and I just repeat what I said because I believe in the reality of love. I believe it's a spiritual quality. I believe honor is something that is real. Disgrace is real. Forgiveness is real. Something spiritual is invisible, but sometimes it can be very, very powerful. The love of a husband and wife, the love between parents and children, they are the most, probably the most important realities in many people's lives. They are spiritual realities.
Okay, let me follow up then. I can define all of those things like love, family, and feelings in purely natural terms as functions of an organism. But why are you not begging the question by saying the definition of spiritual is love, which is spiritual? I want to know what is. Does it occupy space? Does it occupy time? Does it have a weight? Can you measure it along a dimension? How does the spirit, how would you know that your spirit is not just a concept as opposed to an actually existing thing in reality?
Well, you can't measure a spirit. It is certainly not material. But the examples that I have given are very real and very powerful. Now, we can, one is an Australian poet who said that sometimes people can go and be at a concert and be like dogs at a concert. They hear every sound, but have got no understanding of the music, because the music is something that is spiritual and beautiful and real. And that they can't be reduced to, they're connected with physical activities, they can't be reduced to those physical activities.
I would like you to give me an example of a positive statement which, if true, would make your God hypothesis false. In other words, the principle of falsifiability. Or to simplify the question, what would you accept as a disproof of your God hypothesis?
I wouldn't accept the reality of evil in the world as disproving God, because that, to argue against the existence of God, we have to use all God's gifts. We have to use reason. And reason, we have to invoke principles. We have to use the great gift of speech. All these capacities are not explicable in themselves. You can say, I don't go down that direction, I just leave it as a proved fact, I got no idea. That's not what you're saying. You're saying there is no intelligent reason for these things. God can't be disproved. We might not believe in him, but we can't disprove the existence of God.
Someday, since you probably agree with me that science has not reached the end of the road, there are many unanswered questions, but many of those gaps are closing. We now don't think thunder is caused by Thor. We understand electricity and weather. But someday, when these good questions you are raising about the origin of the Big Bang and the fine-tuning of the initial constants and so on, when science does come up with a satisfactory answer for those questions and we go, oh, aha, we just weren't thinking right, someday when those gaps are closed, will you then abandon your faith in God?
Obviously, then, you don't understand what the physical sciences are. Because the physical sciences do not cope. They do not ask the question, why? And even biologists are notoriously reluctant to admit purpose in living life. I remember Julius Kornberg, a very noted biologist, said that purpose in nature is often like a lady of the night. Scientists will appeal to purpose in nature during in the darkness, but during the daytime they won't admit that there is such a thing in reality. It needs science can give it. But the more we know, especially about biology, the more evidence is being provided so we can reason about that and reason logically to the existence of a superintelligence, which is God. Then many things in this life are unjust. 50 million people died in the Second World War. 5 or 6 million Jews. Shocking violence. Most theists believe in an afterlife of reward and punishment. You don't believe in a God. What do you say about all the injustices of this world? Is there any remedy for it? That's the way it is.
By the way, I have no experience with the ladies of the night, so I don't know. And I presume you don't either, so that illustration was for someone else. Since there is no life after death, and there is no cosmic justice, and since there is no retribution in an afterlife, we've got to do it here and now. If we're going to make a difference, we have to do it in this world, which is the only world we have, which is the only world that counts to us. Much injustice will be unpunished. I don't think Hitler is up there somewhere being whipped and beaten. You were a bad boy, bad boy. He's gone. He's dead. That injustice is forever gone. I think the fact that life is not eternal adds more value to life. Because if you think it lasts forever, well, then let's take care of things in the afterlife instead of taking care of them here. Life is much more valuable, much more precious as an atheist.
I find that very bleak. Now, you mentioned the importance to do something now. So I wonder, where are your atheist institutions? We've got, just in the part of Sydney that's the Archdiocese, we've got 80,000 kids or 70,000 kids in Catholic schools. We've got wonderful Catholic hospitals. It's not just Catholic care, but there's Anglican care, there's Uniting care, that I think over 200,000 person visits in the last year. We believe in the afterlife, but we believe this life is very important, and apparently the atheists do. And of course it's not the government, because most of the taxes that are provided for governments come from Christians. This is a majority Christian society. Where are all these atheist groups doing such good work in the here and now? Especially as they believe there's no balancing up, the scales of justice don't work later.
Atheists, in fact, have built and do build hospitals, but would you go to the first atheist hospital in Sydney if you saw it? How many people would have a bias against atheism because of those intolerant teachings in the Bible that the fool has said in his heart there is no God? The Soviet Union is one example of a godless country that built hundreds of hospitals who cared about human beings. Stalin was a horrible atheist, by the way. Hitler was a horrible Catholic, by the way. But we should not judge the religion because of the fruits of its followers. It may in fact be true that we atheists are the worst people in the world. We're totally selfish, and we're out killing and raping and stealing and cheating. Maybe that's, what if that were true? How does that add any evidence for your God hypothesis? All it means is that you Christians are just as nice as the rest of us. When we do good deeds, we're not doing it to trumpet our faith or our institution. We're helping human beings because we love humanity.
Hitler, Dan, was a touch of Catholic because you are a Christian.
Exactly. He was a horrible Catholic.
No. He was as much a Catholic as you are a Christian. You started a Christian and you left. Hitler was a moral monster who hated the church and realized that the Catholic Church was one of his principal opponents.
That's an entirely different debate about which you are entirely wrong, but that would have to be an entire evening. But go ahead with your question. What is your question?
Would you believe that we're talking about the reality of the Spirit and the consequence of believing in God and goodness? You misunderstood me. I didn't say that we theists are as good as you atheists. I said that our record is enormously better. And you weren't able to produce any local evidence.
Is that your question?
And my question is this. Do you seriously suggest that the production of a Shakespearean sonnet, Beethoven symphony, the elaboration of the principle of relativity, could go on, is similar to human digestive processes, as you mentioned in passing, in your reduction to absurdity of the reality of the Spirit?
Yes, it's the same idea, but to a greater degree. In kind, it is the exact same thing. Neurons are firing, emotions are felt, physical processes are happening within a physical brain, which produces what we would call the functioning mind. And if that brain disappears, the mind disappears. So, of course, digestion is much simpler than thought, but they're both functions of a biological organism. And the brain, of course, is an amazingly much more complex organism. So its functions are going to be much more complex as well. It, in fact, might be true that the atheist view of the cosmos is bleak. But truth is not determined by how bleak something is. I mean, if reality is reality and we don't like what we see, are we going to stick our head in the Christian sand and pretend like it's better than it really is? It takes true courage to face a death with no afterlife. It takes true courage to find meaning in the world. My question to you now, if it's true, as you suggest, that the functional complexity of life requires an intelligent designer, why does not the functional complexity of the mind of that designer also require a similar designer?
Precisely as I set out in my first 10 minutes, precisely because the God hypothesis is that God is something beyond nature, that he's a necessary being. He contains God spiritually, he's not a he or a she. God contains in himself, that's an ethical way of speaking, the reason for his existence and source of all goodness and truth and beauty. And rather than continually claiming that God is not like the bloke next door, I think you have to grapple with the proposition put in about the reality of God.
Well, then, following from that, aren't you admitting to us that your initial premise that functional complexity requires a designer is a false premise? Because if there exists beyond nature, I don't know how that happens, and maybe you can define for us what you mean by the word beyond, something that is functionally complex that doesn't need a designer, then why do we who are functionally complex within the unit, why do we need it as well? Don't you see the circular reasoning of your argument? Why is your initial premise then valid if your conclusion contradicts your initial premise? Biology that many other species, dolphins, whales, elephants, chimpanzees, dogs, have altruistic, compassionate, empathetic feelings and behaviors. Now that we know that we humans are not unique in that regard, that we are perhaps to a greater degree more empathetic, but now that we see our place within the animal kingdom, and we see that dogs apologize. We see that whales will sacrifice for each other. We see chimpanzees caring and giving and sacrificing. Now that we see that, how can you claim that there's anything special about the functionings of human empathy and compassion? Aren't we all just biological organisms?
We certainly are biological organisms, and undoubtedly the higher animal organisms have come closer to us. But we have one gift that they don't. We have a gift of language, which presupposes thought. So I remember once being asked by a biologist, how do you know the dinosaurs weren't intelligent? And I said, well, I don't think they produced anything, and also they had very small brains. And he said, yes, but there's another thing, and the development of that was an equal miracle to the development of life. He says, they don't have a voice box. And because you need a voice box so that you can articulate your thoughts and explain them and develop them. So no, a dog can grunt and bark and they can show rudimentary sympathy, but I listed the great achievements of civilization. No animal has come within a bull's roar of them.
Thank you, Dan. A few questions. It's now Cardinal Pell's turn to take cross-examination again.
Did you ask some questions?
It's yours, yes.
I believe in truth and goodness and beauty. And I would like to know from your bleak but courageous viewpoint how you explain truth and goodness and beauty.
Well, I don't believe in any of those things, but I accept them as a part of the human experience. Belief is what you use when you don't have knowledge. If the only way you can accept an assertion is by faith, you're admitting that assertion cannot be accepted on its own merits. So I don't believe in those things. Truth in my understanding, is simply the degree with which a statement corresponds with reality. You make a statement, and if that statement corresponds, we will give it a label of truth. And most truth, of course, is probabilistic, or to a certain degree. Did Homer actually exist? Who wrote the plays of Homer? Maybe, maybe not. We give it a certain degree of confidence. That's all the truth is. Truth is not a thing with a capital T hanging around in the universe. It's the way we measure our propositions and our statements. Goodness is... that was a three-part question, and I only got to answer one part of it.
How the Pope can choose to let you answer it all.
Yeah,
well,
yes.
Well, goodness also is a label. Morality and ethics are a label for how we intend to live in a world with less violence, less harm. So if a mother is hugging and providing for her child, we say that mother is good, right? A mother who is burning a child with a cigarette butt, we say, ooh, that's not a good mother. We measure in physical ways. Goodness is measured in physical, material ways. Goodness is not some ethereal thing that hangs out there. Goodness is a label for those actions and feelings of ours that have the intention of minimizing harm, real harm in the real world. It's much more than that, but there is a perfectly good naturalistic explanation for goodness. Beauty is probably one of those spandrels, a byproduct of our brain. I play jazz piano, and I love playing the right kind of a combo, and I sometimes say, that's beautiful. We like symmetry. Symmetry is no mystery. Symmetry is when things are balanced. Right, we like what you know. Your beauty might be my ugliness. Who knows what? But beauty is the thing that's happening as a brain perceives its environment. Beauty again is a label for a function of a perceiving brain, not for a thing itself that exists in the real world.
Could then. Your goodness is a label, and you're espousing harm minimization. Don't want to do harm to others. Obviously, then you would be opposed to abortion in every circumstance.
No, I think abortion in most circumstances is a good thing. I think a woman who has a problem pregnancy, who chooses to have an abortion, is doing the morally correct thing. It is not 100% either or.
No.
I'm answering your question. Excuse me. In some cases, because morality and ethics are involved with minimizing harm. You can't eliminate all harm. So usually it's a conflict of values. So should I vote for stinky or should I vote for bully? I should pick the lesser of two evils, right? In picking the lesser of two evils is a good thing to do. Most Christians think that good and evil are these binary things that it's either holy good or holy evil. I think a woman, and this is neither your business nor mine, a woman faced with an unwanted pregnancy, especially if it's a threat to her life, is doing an honorable, good, moral thing to take the freedom of choice to terminate that unwanted pregnancy.
There's a comment question. Would it have been, following along these principles of harm minimization, was it a good thing to fight the Second World War? Would we have eliminated the diminished harm significantly if we just rolled over and let the godless dictators, Stalin and Hitler, take over?
Hitler was not godless. Hitler had Gottmietums on his uniforms. He was a member of the Catholic Church in good standing his whole life. He was never excommunicated by the Church. He credited Jesus as his inspiration for helping to exterminate the Jews. He was a very strange, very bad Catholic, but he was not an atheist. And that's slandering somebody. That's slandering us atheists. But in any event, yes, sometimes in order to minimize harm, you have to create harm. For example, no baby wants to have a needle stuck into it. You think it's a good idea to take a needle and stick it into a baby? unless that baby needs a life-saving injection. You will cause that lesser harm for a greater good. Ethics is not a simple baby mentality, like a toddler mentality. This is good and this is bad. Ethics in real life is gray. It's in the middle. So sometimes, yes, we have to take violent self-defensive measures with the intention of an end result, if we're as informed as we should be, that has less harm than if we have not done that. So I think there can be some just wars, although we have to be very careful that our motives are clear on these actions that we take.
Dan, take the floor to give his closing remarks.
Thank you all. There's too much to say in 2 minutes. But for the record, many of the questions I asked George were not answered directly. The falsifiability question, his answer to the question about what is a spirit included the word power. A spirit has power. But power is work over time, and that's a force. And a force is measurable. So I think there's incompatibility or a confusion in his definition of what a spirit is, if it has physical effects and yet it's not a physical thing. We could talk a lot more about that. But I just want to end by saying this. A lot of people come to their faith in God not by contemplating the ontological argument or by thinking about the number of chances of an amino acid forming a 10 to the 40. No, did any of you come to your belief in a God? Maybe a couple of philosophers, right? Most of you came to it for other reasons. A sense of meaning, of purpose, of justice. And you came to it for other reasons, a sense of community, perhaps, or morality. I said earlier that there is no purpose of life, and that is true. In the cosmic picture, we are just like the dogs. We are just like broccoli. But in the immediate picture, life matters to us here and now. There's no purpose of life, and if there were, it would cheapen our lives. It would make us secondary. But that doesn't mean there's no purpose in life. Atheists and agnostics, and in fact all of you believers as well, you find purpose in life whenever there are problems to solve, whenever there is knowledge to gain or beauty to create or inequality to eradicate or the oppression of women often taken by religious institutions, the denial of rights, such as the denial of gay rights, often taken by religious institutions. As long as there's inequality to eradicate, as long as there are hunger to lessen, as long as there are hospitals to build, as long as there's music to write, there is purpose in life. I'm a father. I have kids. I actually have created somebody. Unlike George, I know what it's like to be a father, I presume. I know what it means to have those the paternal feelings. And that gives me an immense feeling of purpose to know that I'm participating in the future of our species. So don't despair that there's no purpose of life, because you create your own purpose in life, which is the only kind of purpose any of us are ever going to find.
Held to give the affirmative's closing comments.
I think I heard Dan say in passing that we're like broccoli or a dog. Now, nobody here believes that. Would you go for the broccoli or the dog?
Broccoli! It doesn't matter!
That all of us very seriously believe that the great human mystery is infinitely more important than broccoli or a dog. And that's based on the fact that we believe that God has created us. The French adventurer and writer, Minister for Culture under de Gaulle, André Malraux, said that no atheist can explain the smile of a child. And Solzhenitsyn, who did more than anyone else to bring down the empire of lies that was Soviet communism, in his Templeton lecture in 83, said, all these terrible things have happened because men have forgotten God. And Milosz, Polish poet, who's lived through communism. Marx spoke about religion being the opium of the people, helped them in their sorrows. Milosz said, the great opium mistaken belief that at the end of their life they will not have the vengeance of God for all their lies and barbarities and treacheries and deceptions. The universe doesn't explain itself. Astrophysics, cosmology, all radically incomplete. I concede that the explanation is wrapped around in mystery, but if we ask the question, we must ponder the answer, and bewildering though it is, that answer is a being called God. And Dante said that to God is the love that moves the sun and all the other stars. And that's my fault.